Hello, everybody. How are you? Are you excited about the election? Okay. You should be. Our nation's at stake, okay? I don't care what side you are on it, but you need to get yourself educated. I'm Jim Gardner. Most of you probably know, you look old enough. I'm a retired chief of police from San Luis Obispo, retired about 25 years ago. My claim to fame tonight is I'm a member of the San Luis Obispo Rotary Club. And Rotary needs to, as we speak, let you know about our four-way test. It starts with, is it the truth? Is it beneficial to all concerned? Okay, and I there are a number of politicians that I know who are starting to live by that. I hope everyone does, okay. So we need, this is one way that we could help. We are in partnership to support the League of Women Voters and everything good that they do. This is one way we can do it. It's been my pleasure to work with Shelley for a couple of years. She was four when I first started. you know her background. We can't be happier than being able to support their efforts. And as personally, I am looking forward to having people like you. You're out here to be educated. You care about what's going to happen. And hopefully you're going to go talk to other people and get them to vote. Get them to vote, okay? All right. Thank you all very much. Madam Chairperson, moderator,
thank you
very much.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. So welcome to the Candidate Forum for District 2. Tonight was made possible by the Rotary. There were five Rotary groups. They were here at 2:30 today helping set up the chairs and tables, so thank you. We want to say thank you to the Slow Rotary Monday Club, the Slow Rotary De Tolosa, the Slow Passport Rotary, the Daybreak Rotary, and the Cambria Rotary. So thank you very much, men and women, for helping. I'd like to welcome our candidates, Mr. Michael Allen Woody, Mr. Jim Daytona. Thank you so much for coming. And thank you all for coming tonight and taking the time to take part in something that's really essential to be an informed electorate. I'm Shelley Higginbotham, and I'll be tonight's moderator. I am a member of the SLO League of Women Voters. The League is a nonpartisan political organization focused on voter education, empowering voters, and defending democracy. Both candidates have signed an MOU outlining the format for tonight and have agreed to the best practices in civil discourse. Now I'm counting on all of you to do the same. I would respectfully ask that you not clap or shout out because it really throws off the candidate's ability to answer, and we want to spend as much time as we can asking as many questions as we can get to, and I know that's why you're here as well. We flipped a coin. Yes, Mr. Daytona won the heads, and so he will begin. Our panelists will each have a 3-minute opening statement, and then we'll have 1.5 minutes to answer each question. Then we'll switch the order. Here's our question sorters here. They're happy to sort the questions. If you have a question you would like to send up here, please raise your hand, give it to one of our runners. They will grab them and bring them up to our sorters, and we'll get to as many questions as we can. The forum is being streamed by AGP on SlowSpan, shown on channel 20, and the League will later stream the forum on our website. Couple housekeeping things. Take a second, please silence your cell phones. And in case of an emergency, I sound like a flight attendant. Our exit doors are in the back here, and this door here could be used in case of an emergency. So with that, we will begin. Mr. Daytona.
Well, thank you. So first, thank you to the League of Women Voters and the Rotary Clubs for hosting tonight's forum. And thank you to everyone joining us here online. Your engagement is what makes this community strong. I'm Jim Daytona. I'm running for county supervisor because, like you, I love this community and share the values that make the second district so special. This is an important moment for our community. We're facing both external pressures and internal challenges. It's not enough to simply understand the problems. We need leadership with a clear vision and the ability to deliver real solutions. Externally, our nation is uneasy about the health of our democracy. The Trump administration will continue to make it hard on us. In spite of court orders, marine sanctuaries, and local opposition, they're proposing to bring oil drilling off our coast. They're stripping our neighbors of their health care and food. They're kidnapping our neighbors and jailing them without due process. We need a local political leader who will stand up to this and fight back. In moments like this, change doesn't start in Washington. It starts in communities like ours. Here at home, the challenges are just as real. Costs are rising, infrastructure is aging, and too many of us are feeling the squeeze. I've spent half my career inside government working to solve problems for regular people like us. The other half has been in the private sector, most recently serving as CEO of the San Luis Chamber of Commerce. Together, those experiences have prepared me to step in and lead on day one. My experience at the chamber has done two important things. First, it kept me deeply engaged in the issues facing our county, from everyday affordability and healthcare to water and transportation infrastructure. I understand the challenges, and I've been part of developing solutions. That said, I don't see a county in decline. I see a county full of opportunity, resilience, and people who care so deeply about this place that they always step up. It inspires hope, and I'm optimistic for us. Second, I've developed and nurtured the relationships needed to get things done. I've worked alongside city and county staff, collaborated with leaders across multiple sectors, and developed strong partnership with elected officials at every level. This will allow me to bring together the necessary resources to deal with those challenges. That's why leaders who know this work have put their trust in me. Congressman Salud Carbajal, Congressman Jimmy Panetta, Assemblymember Don Addis, and County Supervisors Bruce Gibson, Don Ortiz Lague, and Jimmy Paulding have all endorsed this campaign. The people you have elected to represent you have said that I'm the right person to serve District 2 as supervisor. I'm running because I believe we can protect what makes the Central Coast special while ensuring the next generation has a real opportunity to build their future here. That takes collaboration, leadership, and willingness to listen, even when we don't all agree. We need a supervisor who's going to get stuff done. I'm ready to roll up my sleeves and get to work. Thank you.
Okay, now you already broke the rule. I said no clapping. Come on, you guys. I know you can do this. Mr. Woody.
Thank you so much, and thank you to everybody here tonight. This is just absolutely wonderful and heartwarming to see so many people involved in our communities that want to be a part of our democracy, be part of the problems we're facing here today, and deal with the real problems that we are facing here along the Central Coast. For the first time in more than a generation, we have a chance, a real chance, to make a real difference for all of us along the Central Coast. For too many years, representation has been nothing more besides an insider's game for the wealthy and the well-connected. And it's time for this to change. Today, our coastal community stands at a clear crossroads. The choices we make will define the future of our coast, our communities, and our way of life. Can we preserve the unique Central Coast quality of life and charm that people travel from around the world to experience? Or do we fail and we allow this region to turn into another Los Angeles? Or do we go down a path of environmental failure, turning our fishing ports into industrialized communities, destroying our beaches with lithium battery plants, or depleting our fragile aquifers with development when we simply do not have the adequate water resources? It's time to put an end to the status quo. It's time for a new direction. As a licensed civil engineer with over 25 years of professional experience and a master's in public administration from Harvard University, I bring a unique set of skills that can address the very real challenges facing our coastal communities. As a former elected official and a proud tribal council member of the Salinan Tribe of Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties, I have a long proven record of working with community stakeholders, government agencies, and bringing people together for regional solutions. And most importantly, when you come from a legacy family of fishermen, the pioneers, and the Native Indians who actually built this region, representing and preserving this area, our history, and our mixed cultures is not just a responsibility, it's very personal. Thank you so much for having me here tonight, and I look forward to answering your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. That's right. See, at the Coastal Commission, you can wave your hands. Thank you. So the first question is Mr. Woody will answer first. What are your top three priorities specifically for District 2?
2 minutes, right?
Minute and a half.
Oh, 90 seconds. We'll solve it in 90 seconds. Simply put, you know, start with the most basic, which is just, let's start with, we know that we have offshore wind energy issues going on right now. The first thing I would do is make sure that we have a representative who understands the history of this area and understands we cannot afford to have the industrialization of our coastlines go in. We have to prevent the offshore wind energy development from happening here in San Luis Obispo region and in Morro Bay specifically. I am sick and tired of watching this region and specifically Morro Bay being used as the dumping ground for the energy industries. After 75 years, we need a better direction. Number two, it's making sure that we have a loud, strong voice that understands that putting lithium battery plant storage facilities on our beaches and our coastlines should not happen, ever. There are much better places to put these things, but decisions were made 75 years ago in this area to sell county property over to PG&E to build a PG&E power plant. And those problems we're still living with here today, because people are saying, hey, we have that out here. Let's just make Morro Bay the dumping ground for the energy industry. Lastly, we need to make sure and turn back the county policy that says we're going to start allowing growth in our community, specifically Los Osos, for growth to take place when we simply don't have the water and we have seawater intrusion going on. We need to reverse that decision.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. Mr. D'Antona. Would you like me to repeat the question?
No, I'm good.
No, I'm good. Thank you. Okay, so my top three priorities is first to start with environmental issues that protect our central coast. That talks about specifically offshore oil. Offshore oil is being proposed and is a huge threat to our community. We need to ensure that we are protecting our environmental regulations from outside pressures, from the federal government, Trump administration, and make sure that we protect everything that we have built here. Secondly, we need to look at an affordability crisis. The affordability crisis goes to housing, water, infrastructure. Everything we're doing is costing more and more and more. And everything I've seen from as you heard in my opening, is talking about how the pressure is building on everybody. Families who have built their lives here are being forced out. The next generation is not finding a way to stay here. We need to tackle that crisis. And finally, infrastructure. We are looking at infrastructure issues from roads, transportation, moving people from here to there, along with our water, sewer. We're looking at issues all up and down the coast that needs our attention drastically. So those are the top three things that will affect our entire coast and that I want to make a priority of my time as supervisor.
Thank you, Mr. D'Antona. Next question. You'll answer first, Mr. D'Antona. What is your stance on wind farms and wind turbines being possibly located offshore in Morro Bay?
So I have supported the idea of wind, but that is over. The Trump administration has killed that off. It is not coming. In fact, what I really want to focus on is actually the more we talk about wind, we're taking our eye off the crisis that's coming from oil. The Trump administration told Sable down in Santa Barbara to turn on their oil pipeline. Santa Barbara is pushing back. But the Trump administration continues to push hard. They have proposed three leases off of our coast, and we need to be focusing on that. If the idea that they could come in with their emergency, the war that created the emergency, means we have to focus on the oil proposals that this federal administration is putting forward. Wind is not. And we are not going to industrialize our Morro Bay port. That's not happening, and I believe that is our true threat. The oil part is the true threat coming at our community.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
In some respects, I really agree with Jim, and let me capitalize on that. Yeah, absolutely. We need to stand firm on this idea of doing oil drilling off of our coastline. Absolutely. And he is right on that. And this pipeline that the Trump administration opened up in the Southern California, it's a huge mistake. We know this. We know that statistically that pipeline represents less than 0.5% of our national output when it comes to oil. There was no reason to open this pipeline. And in this respect, we do agree. However, I think where we do disagree is that my position on offshore wind and the industrialization of our shores is very much a real threat. In fact, we know that we're continuing to have meetings, port authority meetings, and studies being done to move this project forward. We know that the Trump administration, in fact, has not killed off this project. It's just simply in a holding pattern at this point. The idea to think for 1 second that this is a done project, that it's a project that is dead in the water, no pun intended on that, is simply not true. We know that factually from the meetings we're having, from the lawsuits that are taking place, and the discussions that are still taking place amongst many of our local government and state government, and even our federal agencies.
Thank you. Okay, you're still on, Mr. Woody. Here we go. Please explain your campaign financing and how will that affect your decision making on the board?
Explain my campaign financing.
Maybe your philosophy on campaign financing.
Okay, I'll do the best I can with that.
Well,
I mean, we raise money, obviously. For me, campaign financing is, I think there's far too much money in our campaigns. I've made it very clear in this election that there are three things that I'd like to see done. Number one, I'd like to see campaign reform that limits our contributions to $500 per individual. And during this campaign, I've lived by that. That idea. The second thing is I'd also like to see term limits and the elimination of all financing through corporations, PACs, and LLCs and unions. Why? Because individuals should be the only ones donating to our campaigns. So in this respect, to make sure I answer the question, that's my campaign philosophy. This campaign has been running on that. There is no reason why my limit for donating to a presidential campaign, for example, in this country, is $3,500. In this county, an individual can donate $5,900. How is it that our county is allowing us to have individual donors per cycle of $5,900, but they can't even donate that much to a federal campaign? That's why I believe, and I ran on the idea, that our contribution limits should be lowered down to $500. It should be, the campaign should be ran this way. I'm running my campaign this way, and that's a philosophy that I'd like to bring in order to have the reform needed for our county.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, I got to remember to turn on the mic. I believe I'm accepting donations from folks who want to support my campaign of all kinds. There are certain ones that I won't accept donations from, where I have a value statement. I have not accepted donations from oil companies. I have not accepted donations from PG&E. But what I do believe is that when people donate, they are investing in you. And they're investing in you to get the message out and to share your message. Yes, it would be great if we didn't have to fundraise and we could go out and have a publicly financed campaign. That's not a reality. And I want to talk to every voter that's out there. I want them to know who I am, who I believe, what are my values. And so I have raised money from, as I said in our original first Tribune, Tribune debate. My mom is my number one contributor, and she maxed out, which was awesome. But it really is nobody who donates to my campaign, including my mother, gets anything on a vote, right? There was no donations do not influence my vote. The people of the second district influence my vote. The people who have donated to me are the folks who believe I'm right for the job.
Thank you. Keep that mic on, please. You're up.
This time I left it on.
So with the county at only 1% of goal towards housing the very low income, what do you see as the path forward for the county, as well as what role can District 2 play?
So this is a great question and an incredibly important question. It goes back to my affordability crisis statement. We need to be producing housing at the very lowest levels, right? Right now we have a housing ladder that has rentals, very expensive rentals, or dilapidated rentals, and million-dollar homes. If we want to continue to have restaurants, workers in our, we need to finance our affordable housing. Right now, the county has stepped away from creating any revenues on affordable housing, which allows us to leverage state and federal dollars to build that housing. We need to create it in those city locations, in those urban locations where transit exists, where we can move people around. It is the county's job to build some of this that allows us to build affordable housing. I used to be a believer that the market would deal with it if we created. This supply is, demand for this housing here is inelastic. We could build a million homes and they would still be demand for it. We need to look at affordable housing, legally affordable housing, and through funds that we generate. And I will get into this, not enough time left, but in terms of using our housing for the folks that live here, not as second vacation rentals and all those other pieces.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
Thank you so much. As a professional civil engineer, I deal with these problems. I see what's going on. You know, 40 years ago, you could apply for a set of permits probably anywhere in the state of California and have your permits within about 4 weeks to build a brand new residential home. Today, due to state and a lot of federal, and specifically when you get to something called Title 24 and the California building codes that we have here unique to California, combined with our the bureaucracy that we see throughout all of our communities, it takes the going right now is it takes a year to get a simple set of permits. That's just reality of all of this. Now, how do we deal with this when it comes to affordable housing? We do know that we have such programs for federal grants that we need to pursue, the CDBG, the ESG funds, the HOME and the HUD COC funds federally, statewide, HHP, PLHA funds. We know that those are out here. But the other thing that we also need to talk about is that we do have a unique problem here. And that is, we have a severe water problem in many of our communities, but there are some regions that do have the infrastructure and the water where we can put these items. We need to understand that if we're going to deal with housing costs in San Luis Obispo County, we have to talk openly and honestly over something called supply and demand. If we never deal with a correct amount of supply for people, no matter what we do policy-wise, we will always have a tremendous amount of costs going on with our housing because it's something called an auction market. That's what makes it just so difficult and trying.
Thank you. So along the same line, Mr. Woody,
yeah.
How might you protect our remaining farmland from further development?
Well, a lot of that comes back to the making sure that these farmlands can stay within the Williamson Act, making sure that they have the adequate water and the infrastructure in order to continue their farming, small farming lifestyle. So it is a matter of just making sure that we do support what they need in farming. But the most important part is that we listen to the farming community and we make sure that they have the adequate water, supporting the Williamson Act and supporting what their needs are in these communities. Our farms, our ag, our produce, and everything that we produce here, that's the backbone of who we are in San Luis Obispo County.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most important parts, obviously, is that agriculture is a huge piece of our culture in this community, and we need to ensure that we are doing what we can through our zoning, through our ordinances at the county to ensure that stays. But I think, and we really need to talk about the Williamson Act, which was just referenced, the idea that the property taxes that a farmland pays are not based on what would it be if it was 100 homes, but what is it based on the commercial value of the agriculture they're creating. And so we also have to be cognizant with them to talk about when it makes sense for them to continue farming. We've seen these volunteer fallowing out in Paso, and the Paso wine, that's what it kind of is, the Paso agriculture in the Paso Basin, where they are voluntarily not watering their plant and not putting in crops because it doesn't make sense right now. But we shouldn't punish them for that. We should ensure that they get to keep that space ready so that when they are ready, we are that will be available, because we need to have that. It's what makes our place special. When people drive down here, people come here for that open green space that creates that special feel.
Thank you. Mr. Woody. Did I ask you that already? I'm sorry. Farmland. I'm back. Okay. Mr. D'Antona, you ready? Okay. We live in an environmentally unique region that should be protected for future generations. What is your strategy or strategies for preserving the environment while encouraging economic growth and vitality?
Yeah, this is a great question, and thank you for putting it in. Exactly. I can see the person who did it. What I really want to, this is so important. I think this is one of those distinctions that need to be made between our candidacy. And that is, I believe the data and the science that says we are in man-made climate change. This is important that we start to tackle this issue. And that really gets to the point of us getting our carbon-free energy. We need to transfer off of fossil fuels. We need to protect this space. We need to move on to that so that sea level rise doesn't affect our community. Because as sea levels rise, the saltwater intrusion in Los Osos gets worse, in all of our aquifers gets worse, the more that goes up. We need to tackle this issue from our side. We need to tackle it at a national level. But I want to see ensure that we keep the green spaces, that we keep the pieces that are decarbonizing our air by having oak forests and all of the open spaces that ensure that we are doing our part to mitigate the climate change that is happening.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
Could you repeat the question one more time?
I sure can. Thank you. We live in an environmentally unique region that should be protected for future generations. What is your strategy for preserving the environment while encouraging economic growth and vitality?
Sure. Well, it comes back to some real basic things. One, it's dealing with the effects of global climate change. We have to deal with that. Now, how do you deal with that here locally? It's pretty straightforward. First of all, you have to deal with the idea that we cannot allow for any more water intrusion going on in our communities, such as in Los Osos. That is a tremendous problem that we have out here. But we have a county, and a county that has said, hey, we're going to allow for growth out there. So how do you start protecting the environment? For God's sakes, let's start understanding that we have a water problem going on in Los Osos, one that we have going on in Cambria. How else do you deal with these problems? Making sure that our carbon neutral energy and our energy development, including oil, offshore wind, and putting battery plants on our shores, in our beaches, in our oceans, do not belong there. Making sure that if we're going to do projects such as that, such as carbon neutral energy, make sure that it's in more reasonable places throughout the county. There is no reason to environmentally destroy Estero Bay. There is no reason to destroy these areas that we hold so important to all of us in this region. But we've come under this idea that has said, if we're going to have energy development, by gosh, let's put it down there right off the Embarcadero. And that's a mistake. Let's put it in places that are much more reasonable. We know through the state of California and the Department of Energy that there is plenty of potential carbon neutral energy sources within the county itself that do not go out in the ocean and do not go out on our coastlines. So let's protect those areas. That's how we need to move forward.
Thank you. Keep that mic on. You're up. Mr. Woody, what is your position in keeping the nuclear power plant open?
The Diablo power plant should be closed within about the next 5 years. Extending this is a mistake. Let me explain why. This is an aging infrastructure that was never designed properly in the first place for where it belongs. I'm a civil engineer. You do not put a nuclear power plant on top of a fault line, of a seismic fault line like this. It's something called what's called a thrust fault. I deal with this as an engineer. I mean, think about what I'm saying here today. We have a nuclear power plant sitting on top of a seismic fault line. I mean, this doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And this goes back to what the previous question you just asked me, in fact, which was the idea of, you know, what do we do to protect our environment? Well, first thing we need to do is we need to make sure that if we're going to have these energy sources within the county, put them in the proper place. We are being held hostage by the state of California and the federal government, who doesn't want to deal with the politics of nuclear development, by saying, okay, let's just go ahead and just dump it into San Luis Obispo County and tell them that, hey, we're not going to build anything else, so you're stuck having it on this area right on the coastline on a seismic fault line. It's real funny because everybody will think to themselves, it doesn't happen here. That's only something we read about on TV. But I will tell you, if something goes haywire out there, this entire region is destroyed forever.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, for me, the idea that it would be gone in 5 years is just fake. We do not have enough power in the state of California to offline Diablo Canyon. Gavin Newsom is probably one of the slickest politicians that's ever existed. Doesn't mean I don't like him, but he is. The fact that he was the one that turned and said, we need this back, you know that they need this. If we turned off Diablo Canyon in 5 years, we would all have blackouts. We need to keep Diablo Canyon running for as long until we create that other power source that we can take it offline. That is not in 5 years. It won't be. We haven't put any new. We've stopped it. In fact, my opponent here has said NIMBY-wise, like, don't put anything near me. And the issue is we have it, and we just got to make sure it's absolutely safe. We absolutely need to say, have you looked at the thrust faults? They have. There's independent peer review panel is studying all of these pieces, and we're asking for more information. Yes, there are faults, but that place has been built, and the safety regulations to put it in have been checked. What I will say is the bigger question we need to work on is what do we do with the waste when it's done? And that is a huge issue. But right now, we have safe power that's going on out there. And at some point, yes, we need to throttle and turn it off. But right now, if we did it, we'd be relying on coal power plants and fossil fuels in order to power our state.
Thank you, Mr. D'Antona. So along these lines, if you're not in favor of offshore wind or the long-term use of the Diablo nuclear power plant, what sustainable energy sources do you support?
I'm first this one.
You
right?
Are.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, so yes, I said I was in support of the conversation we were having around wind. I think there is a valid conversation. Whether that's exactly the right place, fine. We can have that conversation. But battery storage is absolutely one of the key points that we need to look at in order to have carbon-free power. I will say it right here. It is not going at the Morro Bay Power Plant. The voters have put it out there. I agree with that. But it does need to go near our infrastructure. We have battery storage down in Napomo that exists. That is how we're keeping solar energy to power in the evening. We need to set these things up around our infrastructure, and we need to ensure it's safe. The current state laws are being proposed right now that are putting forward the regulations that have been checked by fire to ensure we do not have a Moss Landing issue. And so we need to work with that to ensure the safety is being held. But in the end, that is how we're going to ensure our long-term sustainability of carbon-free energy. Because solar, if it's not being stored somewhere, is going to be lost, and we're going to have to turn to something else. And that's where we end up with having to potentially be with nuclear power and other options when we could use the solar we are creating, because there is a ton of it.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
I think it's painfully wrong to sit here and say that if we don't put a battery plant or put these types of projects, let's say down on our coastline or where the, quote, infrastructure existing is NIMBYism. It's not. It's called good planning. It's called common sense, people. Think about it. Would you put a garbage dump next to a high school? No. Is that NIMBYism? No. It's common sense. Is it NIMBYism to say that we have a nuclear power plant sitting on a fault line and you just don't want to hear? No. It's called common sense. That's what's missing in all of this. Now, we can sit here and say, okay, if you don't support, if you want to see things shut down in the next 5 years, this aging power plant, absolutely in Diablo. But here's the solution for it. We know through the United States Department of Energy that the potential energy in wind and solar existing on land in California is far more than all the energy that we need. So here's the solution to it. Start putting onshore carbon neutral projects where they belong in California. But what we're being told here is we're being told, well, you know, Gavin Newsom is a slick politician and he's not going to allow that. So we're stuck holding the bag. And I say we're not stuck holding the bag. I say after 75 years of dealing with this nonsense here in Morro Bay and along this coastline, it's time that we stand up as a community and start saying we're going to take our community back, put these projects where they belong, and start getting the job done for us out here. But the status quo has to stop.
Thank you. All right, shifting gears. Mr. Woody, you're up. So the question is, it's kind of a two-pronged question.
Uh-oh.
Does the Board of Supervisors really control the county budget? And what is your experience with budgets of this size?
Does the county Board of Supervisors really control the budget? Well, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, through the budget hearing process, maybe I'm misunderstanding the question there. And I'm not trying to downplay to be sarcastic, but yes, the county Board of Supervisors controls the budget. Tell me the second part of the question. I'm sorry.
Second part is, of course, what is your experience with budgets of this size?
In fact, quite a bit. I was a former elected official in the city of Fresno, the Fresno City Council. We had a budget that was very similar to this size in a community of almost 500,000 people. I represented about 70,000 people out in northeast Fresno, went through these types of budget hearings year after year after year. So I'm firsthand knowledge of exactly how government budgets work. I also previously served the last 4 years of my life on the Citizens Finance Advisory Committee for the City of Morro Bay in reviewing their budgets year after year after year. I'm very familiar with these kind of budgets. I know exactly how they work. I know exactly what I'm looking for. I know exactly what to deal with. And that's the type of experience that I bring to this.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona.
Well, I think the question actually gets at to more about what we actually can control. Yes, there's a huge budget. But the difference is that not a lot of it is available to turn the knob. Some are federally or state rules govern where it goes. So you actually only get to deal with a small portion of the dollars. And that is where it's incredibly important to have those relationships, to have that experience, to know how to work with your elected officials, to drive forward the issues and fund the things that you think are important, because it takes three votes to move any of these things. And if you do not have that, you're not going to do it. And in terms of size of budgets, this is from the chamber much bigger. But from my experience as chief of staff in the city of Los Angeles, this is tiny. So the idea isn't size. The question is priorities. How are we funding our priorities? How are we taking those dollars and making sure we are focusing on the primary mission of the county and not expending those dollars out into mission creep that is really shouldn't be the focus of our county? We should be delivering those things that are important and the primary role of our county, not separate pet projects and other issues.
Thank you. All right, Mr. D'Antona, we're shifting again.
Okay.
What is your stance on our Sheriff's Department cooperating with ICE, potentially beyond the federal requirements?
Yeah, this is, again, probably another one of those issues where there's a distinction between the two of us, right? We are looking at a Trump administration that has set ICE upon it, the entire nation, creating fear, destroying lives, on purpose. They are absolutely doing this without the constitutional due process that is required. Now, what can we do? Obviously, can't take on the federal government directly. So for our sheriff, I would ask and I would want him to do as little as possible to not work with ICE. Not because I want people to avoid the law. What I want them is the people who are abducting citizens from our community are not being given due process. They are being shipped out of this country when they're citizens. They are being shipped out of this country when they're in the process. They could be married to a citizen. We've seen several. There was a great opportunity to see that where a Canadian woman was married to a man in Texas, and she was held and her child was held, even though they're going through the process. We need the sheriff, when he has the ability to make a determination, to err on the side of our residents and making sure we are doing little to nothing with ICE.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
Yeah, I've had to sit here three times and listen to Jim tell me how I disagree with him, put some comments in my mouth. So let me address this pretty frankly on this. You know, we see it with our own eyes. We see how ICE is improperly trained. We see that as a federal agency. We've seen it with the shootings that took place, the killings that took place. There's no question in my mind that ICE is completely improperly trained when it comes to de-escalation tactics. I've talked with our sheriff about this at length. They understand, the sheriff understands, and I understand very clearly that we should not be working with any of these federal agencies in order to help them until such time that the federal government can demonstrate that these agencies are equipped to do their job correctly, bar none. It's not a conservative issue. It's not any issue like that. This is a human issue. We're a better country than that. And I've seen people come along and say, hey, you know what? They had it coming. No, they didn't. I think it's deplorable how ICE has been trained or improperly trained at this respect. But we are a nation of laws. We have to make sure those are followed. But likewise, this county should not be cooperating with any federal agency that's improperly trained or not doing their job correctly. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Woody, how can you address the homeless crisis and the mental health challenges in SLO County?
You know, it's interesting. I went through the Morro Bay Police Academy recently, and along with the Sheriff's Department Citizens Academy as well. And when you first find out that the mental health calls represent about two-thirds to three-quarters of the calls that we're getting here in our police department, that should be alarming to all of us. I mean, think about that for one second. We're not talking about calls that are coming for, you know, what some of us might conceive as a, you know, very quick shooting emergency going on. But these are mental health calls. So how do we deal with this? We have to realize that we have to, we have to realize that this is a very unique problem when it comes to mental health in this community. We have been shutting down our facilities too much and not funding them correctly. Our budgets need to be clear and need to start making this a priority. We cannot look away from people simply because they live on the street or they're homeless. Or we say to ourselves, you know what, that's somebody else's problem. It's every one of our problems. When you see somebody out there, all of us need to be participating in helping these people. We got about 1,400 people who are homeless in this county. We got a lot of mental health issues going on. We deserve to prioritize this within our budget and make it a level one priority.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, this is one I have a lot of experience with, both in my former 60,000 people on the street of Los Angeles, where they have no chance of coming back from that. We show in our county 1,200 to 1,500 people. We have a real opportunity to stem the bleeding. We need to focus. There isn't one silver bullet that's going to solve every issue on homelessness. I've served on the Homeless Services Oversight Committee for the county in my role as chamber CEO. And I got a chance to sit in there and talk about these issues. What I saw was a system that is broken in the county. We couldn't move to actually deal with the real crises. We have three different homeless organizations serving the county of San Luis Obispo: ECHO, CAPSLO, and Five Cities Homeless Coalition. Why do we have three different ones doing it where we sprinkle a little money to each of them rather than figuring out who does what best and going after the issue? We need to make sure we get at the folks who are on the verge of homelessness, that we don't let them slip into homelessness before trying to deal with the main issue, the big issue of mental health crises. If we can start to stem that bleeding, we of people falling into homelessness, we absolutely can make a difference. Our problem is not big enough to write off. We have an ability to fix it, and I really want to make that an issue.
Thank you, Mr. D'Antona. Kind of along the same boat, this is about health care. So let's talk about health care and the lack of physicians in our county, and what are some of the solutions to improving health care for everybody?
90 seconds for a health care solution. Got
it. Got it.
Okay. Well, yeah, you take the other 90 seconds. So what is most important is in my role, I got a chance to work with Sue Anderson of Dignity Health, Ryan Ashlock of Adventist Health, and talk about why are we seeing this challenge. And folks, I know there's a thing out there, we're a rural designation, and that's why we're not getting it. It's not that. It isn't. We've gone as far as we can on that piece. The issue is we need the affordability crisis. When doctors try to come here, they're like, let's see. Can you pay me enough, a new doctor, to live here, to move my family here, for me to start a family here? Do you have anybody here I can even have a social life with, right? We have people who are 25 and younger, my age and older. We're missing a key group in the middle. We have a lot of issues to tackle, but they're all manageable. We have to get on it. We have to tackle housing. We have to tackle these pieces where we have the ability to incentivize doctors and create the environment is what we need to do, because the private sector has to solve this for us. But as a county, we need to create the environment where they can do that. And it's happening. We're getting Cottage Health, UCLA Health, right, Dignity Health, and Adventist here. And Adventist is going to spend $200 million on a hospital upgrade here. They wouldn't do that if they didn't think they could make it work. The needle is moving so slowly. Believe me, I don't even have a primary care physician. But I know. So it's a serious issue we need to tackle.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
Well, we have to tackle it because we got to get Jim a doctor really quick. So there. Right, especially after this, yes, going through all this. I'm glad that Jim brought up the idea of also, do they have the social life? They can, doctors can hang out with you and I, and that would go along well, too. Look, Jim brings up an interesting point on this, and in this respect, he's right. When people want to relocate here, whether it be in physician, attorneys, or any type of professional, the first thing that comes to mind is cost. We realize that our cost structure here in San Luis Obispo is extremely difficult. Now, I go back to my experience as an engineer. I can tell you exactly how construction costs go up. It's one thing to keep saying we need to have that discussion, we need to do this, we need to tackle it. Let me tell you how you tackle it. Number one, we have to fix a system in which it takes a year to get a silly little permit for a house out here. Number two, we need to work with our state agencies to make sure that they start repealing the California building codes and start going back to more federal codes that work for the rest of the United States but continue to clog things up here. Number three, we need to deal with our state agencies that continue to come down on us with issues like CEQA. CEQA originally in the 1970s was adopted for government projects. It has turned into every project that we have out here. So this is going to be a multifaceted, solution that we have to work in conjunction with our state and even our federal people to get a solution to that. But at the end of the day, we have to do it because we got to make sure we get a doctor for Jim. So we got to take care of that.
At least one.
Thank you. Mr. Woody,
yeah.
How can you support our immigrant community?
How can I support the immigrant community? Well, my families were pushed out of here 250 years ago, but we'll talk about that some other time. You support the immigrant community, simply put, like this. Let's stop looking at people who have a different life, a different skin color, and different people that come here to this country as somehow they're the bad people. They're not. How do you support the immigrant community? Making sure that we understand as a county and even as a country that so many of these immigrants are coming to this country for a new life. Now, why are they coming to this country? A lot of times that's That is federal policy that has been detrimental to our foreign, to what should be our foreign allies in other countries. So we do it by doing that. Number two, we start to understand that we are not a homogenized culture here. We are a culture of many different cultures. I come from one of them. I come from a Native Indian culture. We have all kinds of different practices that we have going on, and all other types of religions in our, in my culture, my family. We have to start understanding that there's more to this than there's what I call the standard American way of looking at things. And number three, the last thing we need to do is we need to start being aware how diverse we are and support that diversity. Now, statistically, we're not a very diverse county, and that can be very intimidating for a lot of people. But let's keep that in mind, that we actually are a diverse community, a diverse county, and let's start making sure that we can do the best we can personally on a day-to-day basis to understand all the different cultures that are here in this region.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing we have to do is make them feel safe. Right now, there's fear. They don't have any idea of who's on their side, who's not on their side. We are not protecting the immigrant community here. Even if they're here legally and have a, they are scared. And we are have to recognize that and do what we can to protect them. I think next piece is we really need to be welcoming, right? We do a lot of things as white males, and as white folks who think like, oh, I understand what they're, let's listen. We need to listen. We need organizations that help us build a bridge to make sure we go out and try to connect. Diversity Coalition, folks doing the great work, healthcare, the county's main role is being the safety net for folks. But are we doing the outreach to these communities to ensure that they understand what services are available, how they can succeed here, how they are welcomed here, and how we want them to be a part of this community? It is one of the reasons we're not seeing that diversity. We need to be more open and welcoming to touch that point and ensure that when they do, they know they're safe. And right now, that they don't know where that is. And it's a huge issue that we need to tackle if we really want to build diversity of our, for our community, which is so important.
Thank you. We're going to shift over to Los Osos. We have a handful of questions relative to Los Osos. The first one, there are residential and agricultural users who pump unlimited water from the same water basin. What would you do to monitor and safeguard their extraction?
So we actually, as part of the basin, Los Osos Basin Management Committee, we've moved to a new modeling system for evapotranspiration, which actually measures through satellite how much water is being used. And that is definitely one of the pieces looking at the agricultural uses. That piece measures the evaporation of water off of those, and that has been proven to be a good model to show that's about the right usage. Additionally, we have seen as part of the studies that we have done that our basin management right now is about 1,700 to 1,800 acre feet a year coming out of the Los Osos Basin. Our transient model, the model that tells us what's sustainable, says 2,000. I talked to a resident recently who was here in the 80s and said, Jim, we had a third of the population and we were pulling 5,000 acre feet a year out of these systems. The systems that are being put in place are monitoring that aquifer to protect it. It is not an overdraft, we are managing it. It definitely has opportunities to be better, that we can do more to manage the basin. But when we're allowing 2,000 acre feet a year, and right now we're at 1,700 to 1,800 acre feet, we are sustaining it. We just need to figure out how to do more with that water.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
Let me explain to everybody in this room, if you don't know this, what sustainable yield is. Sustainable yield is not just a number based on water and acre feet. Sustainable yield, under the court ruling of 2015, is actually three things. It's your volume of water, it's your what's called constituents, which are your nitrates, your the chlorides that are into this. And we have to make sure that what we do is we understand that when people come forward and say, everything is fine, we're not an overdraft. Yeah, we are. Got news for everybody. If you don't think we are, go read the reports and you're not understanding the issue. Look, we know that right now, if we do no growth whatsoever, even though we've been really good at reducing our water usage out there, we know that the chlorides in our lower aquifers continue to come in and continue to say, we have seawater intrusion going on if we do no other growth. We also know, based on the nitrate levels that are in the upper aquifers, we know that those are increasing over the years. Those are the types of things that have to be addressed in order to meet the court order, what's called sustainable yield. We are an overdraft. We are not meeting the requirements of sustainable yield. The idea that the county is going to come forward and say, let's start allowing for more growth out there, is completely wrong. We need to reverse that. The county was wrong in this, and that's where we need to go with this.
Thank you. Mr. Woody, what is your plan for Los Osos? We need infrastructure work, parks for active recreation, mm-hmm. and support.
Hold on, let me get the notes on. Say that question one more time. Let me make sure I get all three of those
on
there. Yeah.
Please. We need infrastructure work,
right.
parks for active recreation,
parks.
And support.
Support, okay. The first thing that we need to do is understand that we can't have growth in Los Osos until we have adequate water supplies. Nothing happens until that takes place. We cannot go forward in these communities and say, look, there's enough water out there, let's just turn this place into another Malibu. That's the concern that I have, my family has, and all of us have in our coastal communities. So here's how you do it. There are two things we need to have. The first thing, we need to get adequate water out there. Once we have a plan put into place that is sustainable for water to get out there, the second thing we need to do is put in the proper plans, not just for Los Osos, but stretching all the way along our coastal communities, stretching from Montana de Oro up away all the way to the Monterey County line, and put in those preservation and cultural preservation and community preservation plans that will protect this region and not allow it to turn into another Malibu, another Los Angeles, another San Diego, or what's going on in Monterey, even Carmel. So to me, there's a two-pronged system here. One, it's working on and finding an answer to the water problems. Number two, you've got to put the plans into place so when we do have the water put into place, we preserve our communities for what they're supposed to be. Anything outside of that, I'm not interested in supporting it.
Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, absolutely. First key is resiliency of our water supply. It needs to ensure that we have the water that is necessary for the community that exists there today to continue to be there for the long term. I think it's dangerous to then tell people that we are an overdraft. Paso is an overdraft. Our community is not. We need to do things to establish water resiliency. Absolutely. We need to clean the upper aquifer. We need to get what's happening right now, Cabrillo Estates, on our sewer to ensure, hopefully, that we're removing the nitrates out of there. There are things to do to ensure our water is sustainable. Additionally, right now there's a conversation. Could Los Osos get tied into state water through the pipeline that comes right over here, right over here, and make it so for the long term of that community, we have a sustainable water. But once we do that, we need to upgrade all the infrastructure. We are watching flooding and, our roads where some people really enjoy it, the giant dirt roads, but we need to ensure what we have there is comes forward and make sure our community stays whole. And I am all for improving the infrastructure, and that goes to parks, that goes to roads, that goes to sidewalks. When people on children leave Monarch Grove Elementary and they need to walk to the library, they have to walk into LOVR, Los Osos Valley Road. I did it. It's scary, and I'm a 6 foot, 200 pound dude.
Okay, thank you. Mr. D'Antona. What is your position on desal water for the county, since we're talking water?
Yeah, why not? It was just here the other night, wasn't it? I think this is an incredibly important project for the long-term sustainability of our community. What has been brought forward is an idea, and I think it's an important idea that we need to investigate. We do not know what the next or what the droughts will look like coming. Again, climate change is real, and it is changing drastically. Desalination should be our last fix for our water piece, but it takes 15 to 20 years to get it going. If we wait until we absolutely need it, we're going to be too late. So what I'm really in support of, I think there's a really great conversation about what's in South County, the South County water plant and the former Phillips 66 plant that have the opportunity to be these places. And what that would allow us to do in 15, 20 years, whenever this might come forward, is to start to think of water as a community resource. We have been stuck too long on this is mine. I worked with the city of San Luis Obispo. They're going to be fine with water for a long time because they locked up Nacimiento water, Santa Margarita water, Whale Rock water. And so why is one community have all those assets when others are struggling? We need to have a bigger conversation about regional water, but desal's a part somewhere down that 15 to 20 year road.
Thank you. Yeah. Mr. Woody.
I'm sorry, I'm just getting too excited to talk about this. Desalination, it's an interesting but very expensive technology right now, and we know this. I was actually at that meeting in Morro Bay the other night. I'm losing track of my days. Campaign's been going too long. But yeah, no, I was at this meeting, and I've looked into desalination projects, and I've driven around. I've looked at other projects throughout California on this. It's highly expensive. Can it work here? It may. I don't know. The concern that so many of us have is that you start with the most basic thing, which is how do we dispose of the brine? How do we deal with something like this in an area that is known for its environmental sensitivity? I mean, this is a very unique area, folks. You know, I've seen other areas across this country and around the world go down the drain really quick when we let go and say, hey, you know what? It's a neat project. It's shiny. Boy, that company has a really nice website, and they got a really neat looking brochure, and then the project goes in, and all of a sudden we continue to go down the path of losing our environmental region, what makes this place so great. So yes, it's a technology that could very well be part of our future. It would be way off in the future. I think Jim and I agree on this one, that it's way off in the future on this, but it always has to be looked at in terms of the cost structure. And most importantly, what is it going to do to our environment? Because if it does anything to harm this environment, we have to stand firm and protect this area.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. Next question. Specifically, what would you do to help reduce the fire fuels in our district, especially in Los Osos, to mitigate the loss of life and property?
Fire is a very serious problem, and when it comes to our areas along this coastline, we know that we have certain areas in this region that if they went up right now, it would make the Palisades fire and the other fires that we have seen here in California pale in comparison. We know that Cabrillo Estates, we know this up in Cambria especially, we know that there are areas up there that we need to start working with as a county, the local landowners out there, and start putting in the emergency evacuation places and lanes off of those streets up there. Now, up in Cambria, for example, we have an area, the southern part of Cambria, just south of the Fiscalina Ranch. And we know that all of those homes up there, which represent almost half the community, there's only two roads out there, Ardath and Burton, are the only two roads to get in and out of that community. We know that out here in Cabrillo Estates, and we all look at it, we can see them up there on the hill, we know if that goes up in flames, there's virtually no way to get out of there. What we'd have to do is we have to take a look at those areas and potentially off of Cabrillo Estates to go off of Rodman Drive and work with the neighboring landowners and start putting the proper ingress-egress places so people can get out in a state of emergency. I do not think we're properly prepared to deal with an emergency out here, candidly. I think we need to have what I would say would be simulations and start making sure that we do have those plans into place. So it would have to go along those lines.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, it's absolutely correct that we need to have evacuation routes and more of them for the communities like Cambria, like Cabrillo States, and figuring those out. But really, that gets at dealing with the problem as that's a reactive issue. We need to be proactive on this, right? We need our firefighters out here helping us determine where, and they're the experts, right? Where are we seeing something that is absolutely a threat, right? Montana de Oro has a ton of eucalyptus trees, right? The whole thing. And so where are we in there? Are we using the Conservation Corps to go in and clean out that place? Or is that the right move? Do we have the right people telling us what to remove and what not? Are they bringing back new fuels by doing some of the work they're doing, right? The key is prevention, and we need to get on it. We need to have that. And some of that is needing more fire staff. We need people on those trucks. We need those inspectors. We need those folks who know this is what's going to happen if it comes. So therefore, let's deal with mitigation right here. And then that way, when it does happen, that what we've done hopefully mitigated that, and it gives firefighters enough time to get that community out of there.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona, how would you protect the rent control ordinances that apply to mobile home park residents here in the Central Coast?
This is such a great question. Thank you for whoever put that in there. It is, oh, great. Great job. It is so important. It's the only affordable housing on the Central Coast. It is really some of the most important things we need to do, right? And the great part is this community has embraced it. We see it in Los Osos. We see it in Morro Bay. But we're seeing a threat come to it through the idea of, well, are my rents going to go up in an amount that I can't control? Is a private company going to come in here and flip it? Now, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I think it's unfortunate, the county doesn't have that control. What it does have is access to the state to ensure that our state legislators are hearing that, right? When I pick up the phone to call Senator John Laird, when I pick up the phone to call Assemblymember Don Addis, who I know already supports these ideas, we'll make sure that we are fighting hard to ensure that that affordability stays. That is, again, folks' only opportunity. And if they have to leave, it is there's nowhere else to go that would match their life here. And I really, really believe this is, we need to figure out how to do more mobile home ideas if we truly want to create affordable housing.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
The rent control that we have here in these mobile home parks 100% needs to be absolutely supported all the time as vigorously as possible. You know, Jim said it really well. We live in a very expensive area of this country. For a great many people, those that are living in some of these areas, this is it for them. They can't go anywhere else. This is not a, you know, well, let's just let the markets run their way. And hey, probably Jim and I agree on this. I mean, a lot of us, you know, both of us come from a, you know, market-oriented type of ideology in a lot of respects. But in reality, that we have a very, but we have a very skewed problem here when it comes to our affordability. So there's no question in my mind that we need to be fervent and adamant in supporting the rent control to make sure that these people living in these areas do not have any problems or financial distress that would force them to move out of there. So yes, we need to do everything we can to support that.
Thank you. Mr. Woody, please describe how you can prevent or protect our community from the effects of climate change. Minute and a half.
You get the other 90 seconds. What we need to do is we need to understand to prevent, we need to do everything we can with our policies that address climate change. Now, here we go down the path of talking about everything from, we need to make sure that we need to work forward on carbon neutral type of energy developments that's on land and not in our oceans or along our coastlines. We need to make sure that we do other types of things as well. We need to be better stewards of our lands. My family comes from this. We understand this. We understand this as Indigenous Indians, and my family's incoming that came from the Toro Creek Indian Settlement. We understand that the importance of living out here is a privilege. And to pay for that privilege, we need to start living as minimalist as possible and make sure that we do even the daily things. You know, whether we make sure we have our bags that we take to the grocery store, that we make sure that we work on, that we make sure that we do those things in our day-to-day lives that cut down on our carbon footprint as much as possible. Living out here is just a very unique system, society that we're living out here. We know we have water problems. We know we have those environmental problems. So it comes back to what we can do as individuals and what the county can do to make sure that we implement some of these policies in order to protect the global climate change problems that we're dealing with here today.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, this goes back to the point we talked a little bit about before, right? We got to decarbonize our energy footprint. It's automatic. We need battery storage. We need safe battery storage. We need other types of energy products wherever those are going to come up. And we need to get off the fossil fuels. That's automatic. That's what we can do as a community. Even if it's localized in small amounts, right? Are we helping incentivize, our state legislators helping incentivize getting solar on roofs? Are we moving that needle on that piece? What I really think, additionally, by having agriculture in our community, we are removing carbon from the air. We need to, again, continue to incentivize our ag community to do that work, right? There's a balance between water, but there is a need for that to happen. Additionally, we need to improve our transit. Right now, we're creating zoning, really. We're creating jobs in one part of our community and housing in another part of our community. And we are driving our cars 20 and 25. Look at the traffic going north on 101. Look at the traffic all the way on the south of 101, right? If we put jobs in those places, that would limit the amount of vehicle miles traveled and decrease our carbon footprint. And then we are doing the right thing for our environment. And so I would do that along with looking at how our buildings and water heaters are used.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona, as a county board of supervisor, what could you do to help neighbors deal with problems of code enforcement?
Code enforcement, yes. I think we could hire 200 code enforcement officers tomorrow and still not have enough. But it absolutely is a prioritization of what is happening. I was literally walking down a block here over in Los Osos and found a house that was engulfed by vegetation. No one could get in and out of that place. How is it still happening? And I talked to the neighbors, what's happening? They're like, well, he's a nice guy. We don't bother anybody. And we're not sure the county's gonna. I'm like, no, this is dangerous. And so immediately called code enforcement, which said, look, we're hiring as many people as we can. We need to prioritize code enforcement. We need to have people do this work. It's not neighbor-to-neighbor disputes that's really the problem. It's the issue that some of these are life safety matters that we need to deal with. And we need to prioritize that, right? We have a one in Cambria who has an unpermitted pool, which doesn't have any fencing around it. That's dangerous. People could fall in, right? You could have drownings. We need code enforcement is key, but we need to prioritize to use those. And one of the things that's key is making sure your representative has a great a relationship with those code enforcement officers to make sure they want to go help. Because right now, those resources are strained, and we need more of them.
Thank you. Mr. Woody.
Yeah, code enforcement is a real interesting issue. I mean, we see it all the time. I see it with even neighbors that we're dealing with here in Morro Bay, which is a little bit outside of the county. I get it. It's an incorporated city. But code enforcement is more than just saying, well, the neighbor has their radio on too loud or something along those lines. We're dealing with a lot of homes and residences out there that are unsafe, fire hazards, overgrown. We have property out there and buildings that by our own codes need to be demolished. I know people personally that have appeared before the county grand jury that have tried to explain that we need to do something about this. Now, presently, the county isn't doing anything about this. They're not taking any of this seriously. Why? Because they don't want to deal with the phone calls. That's the reality of it. They don't want to deal with the blowback of saying, we need to have code enforcement out here. But here's the deal. We need to make sure that we put this as a top functioning priority in our budget, period. If we don't do it, then we're not supporting these communities. A lot of us have lived out here for many, many generations, and even the people who have moved out here recently, we're all saying the same thing. Look, can we at least have some basic code enforcement to take care of some of these problems? How much time does it really take to drive by somebody's house and to sit there and say, this is the address, and send them a letter? I mean, how much time does it take the county to do something like that? I mean, so this idea that just simply says, well, you know, we need to throw more money at, yeah, we do need to do that. But gosh dang it. I mean, we all see it out here. How much, what is wrong with our local government that we can't do these simple things like this? But yeah, it's very frustrating. We're all dealing with it.
Thank you. Mr. Woody, what is your stance on further oil development in SLO County?
No. I got 85 seconds. let me have another 85 seconds on this, okay? Here's the thing, but there's something to remember when it comes to oil development. I have ran across constituents that would definitely like to see an oil-free world that we could live in today. I like to think that a lot of those comments come from saying that what they're really asking for is, can we do better with our diesel engines, with our carbon footprint, and on with that. But there has to be reality to all of this, is that no, we should not be expanding oil in this county. I mean, and don't even get me started on fracking, that's a disaster unto itself. But we always have to remember that when it comes to oil use, every product out here in this community, in this room, and everywhere else is affected in one form or another by the use of oil products, natural gas, et cetera, et cetera. So let's kind of keep that in mind. But expanding any of this, especially out into our oceans and in our coastal communities, absolutely not.
Thank you. Mr. D'Antona.
Yeah, it's absolutely no. There is no further expansion needed. This is a resource that needs to go away and is going away. So there's no need to actually start doing more to bring it forward. I think a key point is we need to start the making sure we're transitioning folks, and I'm not talking about onto the carbon-free transportation, carbon-free pieces out there that allow them to move. But the problem is affordability, right? We have people that go to job, minimum wage job. Can they afford an electric car right now? We're almost there. But we need to ensure that we have the infrastructure so that people can transfer onto that and we can get off of this. Because again, we're sitting, federal issue, in a war in the Strait of Hormuz over oil. And what can we do in our side to actually transition away from that? And we need to do all of those pieces. I think it's really the main issue also, you brought up fracking. The federal government owns space right across from Los Osos Middle School. And at any point, we could be in a battle there. We need to ensure there's a line in the sand. We are not expanding those issues, fracking, oil development in our county.
Thank you. Believe it or not, we are at our last question. You have crushed this. We're at question 22. Well done, gentlemen. Okay, so there is a grassroots effort to place a measure on the ballot to create a half-cent tax restricted to streets and roads. Mr. D'Antona, you're up first, and tell me your opinion of this.
Awesome. Yes, a huge supporter of this. It's an incredibly important issue. There are only two counties in the general part of the state with most of the population who do not have a self-help tax that lets us leverage state and federal dollars to build infrastructure for us. One of those counties is Ventura. The other one is San Luis Obispo. We do not have it. And we, in 2016, they brought this forward. It fell short by 430 votes. 430 votes cost us, over that 10-year span, nearly $700 million for infrastructure, because we would have leveraged it three and four times to build our roads, to build that sidewalk from Monarch Grove Elementary to the library. If we pass this, our roads get improved. It is divvied up amongst the communities so that they define what these projects are, for what's needed, fixing roads in Morro Bay, fixing roads, building sidewalks, incredibly important. And best of all, it's not just the residents of San Luis Obispo County who pay it. The visitors who come here and who use our roads and put stress on our infrastructure also pay into it. And we use that to multiply it for multiple millions of dollars to fix our county infrastructure.
Thank you, Mr. D'Antona. Mr. Woody.
And let me expand my next 90 seconds to take off where Jim left off. This would make a good ad on TV, in fact. This is really a good idea. Let me expand a little bit on what Jim was talking about. I served as the regional vice chair for the Fresno County Transportation Authority a few years ago, and where we implemented our what was called Measure C half-cent sales tax. This is an important tax to adopt. Now, the one caveat that I've always had with this, and I've made it clear to the people who are supporting this and the people writing the legislation, is that I do not want to turn this into a half-cent freeway tax that begins to turn our place into Los Angeles. This is not, it should not and ever be used and designed for, let's build a freeway grid system in order to destroy this area in the next 50 years. This should be, and I want to make sure of this, a half-cent sales tax that takes care of our local roads, our local infrastructure, and different types of transportations, which also include bicycle lanes, and get them off the streets like in downtown San Luis Obispo, and stop doing these green lanes that just clog up everything. It's making a mess out of this. When I talk about lanes, I'm talking about bike paths in the middle of our country area, in our more rural areas and along our communities, where you see it all across the country and around the world. They have hundreds of miles of these things in so many different communities, and they work great. But let's make sure that we're not turning this into another freeway system, and let's make sure that we also don't turn it into, thinking that this is about putting more green lanes in all of our, on our local streets. That would be a huge mistake.
Thank you. It's time for closing statements. Woo, you did it. Okay, so Mr. Woody, you are first. You have 3 minutes. Yeah.
Do they really want to hear us for 3 minutes? I'm not really sure of that. From the bottom of my heart, being a part of this process has just been absolutely unbelievable. Seeing all of you here today with a lot of differing opinions is exactly what democracy is about. Being a part of this for the last year of my life has just been one of the most amazing experiences I've ever gone through. And I will get choked up when I sit there and say my mother is here tonight, who's also, by the way, who's also my biggest financial supporter too. So I got the mom endorsement. So you just remember that. Yes, it is absolutely key. The key is if I can get your mom to endorse me, then that would be it'd be over right there. but at the end of the day, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for having us here today and having me here today. We really are at a crossroads in our communities. You know, we have two different directions that we can go with things. We can go down a direction that will begin the industrialization and the slow cancer of industrialization in our communities, and will ruin an area that is so pristine and so beautiful that people travel around the world to come here? Or do we go down a new path? Do we go down a path of saying, you know what, after 75 years of looking at these three stacks down here and people telling us, well, that's your lot in life for the Central Coast and for the people of Morro Bay specifically, it's not our lot in life. Let's turn the page on that and let's do something different. How many of you realize that those three stacks, that property was actually owned by the county? It was bought by the county from the United States Department of Defense, and it was bought as a 120-acre regional park. 3 years later, it was sold to PG&E. A lot of people don't know the history of all this. I come from a family that watched all of this go in, and we're still upset over this. I'm part of a tribal group that has seen the destruction of these lands for many, many decades, if not centuries. We have a chance to preserve this area. That's what I'm fighting for. I like to go down a new path and not go down a path of development in our communities where we don't have water. And simply saying, and I find sometimes that it can be hard to get people to say there is a new way, but I truly believe that there is a new way. And that's making sure that when we do our development and our carbon neutral energy resources in this county and in the state of California, we put them in more appropriate places. We can have both. We can have carbon neutral energy, protect our oceans, protect our beaches, and protect our coastal communities. And if we can do that, we can set the example not only for California, but the rest of the United States and for many other places around the world. And that's my vision for this area. So I say we turn the page and let's move forward in that direction. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for having me here tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Woody. All right, Mr. D'Antona.
Oh, thanks. Once again, I want to thank the League of Women Voters and the Rotary Clubs for making the forum possible. I also want to thank our audience who've come to participate and help inform their vote. And I want to thank Michael for this willingness to step up and serve. Truly an amazing piece, and if you haven't done it, don't. It's not all it's cracked up to be. Over the last hour and a half, you've heard a lot about policies, proposals, and challenges, but at the heart of everything I've discussed, protecting our coastline, water, infrastructure, standing up for our neighbors, this campaign has always been about one thing, you. It's about whether our communities will have the resources to sustain itself. It's about whether a young family and future generations can afford to stay here and thrive. It's about whether a small business owner can keep their doors open. It's about whether our seniors can age with dignity in the community they raise their family in and help build. It's about whether your voice is heard and respected at the county level. Public service is about responsibility, to represent you, to listen to you, and to fight for you when it matters most. There are going to be challenges to our community from the outside. The Trump administration's real threat to force offshore oil off our coast, tearing down our environmental standards, creating a constant state of fear. We'll also have challenges from the inside, the cost of living, jobs that will help our next generation stay here, and the infrastructure to support our community. This isn't going to be easy, but we need to look forward, not backward. You've heard that I have real ideas and offer solutions, that my experience has given me the tools to bypass the learning curve as your next second district supervisor. I don't claim to have every answer, but I do promise this. I'll show up, I'll listen, and you can bank on this. I will absolutely do the work. And I will make the decisions guided by what's best for the people of the second district and our county, not by outside noise, not by the needs of the community, but by the needs of the communities I live in and serve. Almost there. One more time. This district deserves steady leadership, practical solutions, and someone who understands that the job is about we, the people, someone who will get things done. This is why so many trusted leaders have endorsed my campaign for supervisor. Congressman Salud Carbajal, a former county supervisor himself, Congressman Panetta, Assembly Member Don Addis, who served as a council member right here in this room and is a constituent. That support has also come from organizations like Central Coast Labor Council, Planned Parenthood, and the SLO County Democratic Party, who stand up for the people in our community. If you believe, as I do, that our future should be shaped by the people who live and work here, then I humbly, respectfully ask for your support. Let's move the second district forward together. I'm Jim D'Antona, and I ask for your vote.
Thank you. Okay, before you leave, couple things. First, thank you, gentlemen. You're really great role models for civil discourse. It's really great. It's refreshing.
Yeah.
It's really refreshing. And this has been a great audience. Thank you all very much. If you want to see this forum, it will be shown on Slow Span, the Slow Span website tomorrow, and the League of Women Voters YouTube channel. So thank you, volunteers, and drive home safely.
Yeah, it was-